Today on Straight Talk Africa, reaction to the latest political developments in Kenya and Zimbabwe. 93-year-old President Comrade Robert Gabriel Mugabe is gone. Could this be the end of an era of socio-economic injustice for the Zimbabwean people in particular, and Africans in general? And might this just be the birth of a new type of African leadership? That's coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America studios here in Washington. I am Shaka Sali.
Our viewers and listeners on the continent and elsewhere. I'm Ayan Bior, your social media reporter.
Today, we are discussing the reactions to the latest political developments in Kenya and Zimbabwe.
And coming up later, our topic generated a lot of discussion through emails, Facebook, and Twitter comments. We'll reveal some of them ahead on Straight Talk Africa.
We look at the significance of this week's rapid major political developments in Kenya and Zimbabwe. My colleague, Paul Sisco, has more.
I did it my way.
Well, he had been doing it his way for 37 years as president. Tuesday, Robert Mugabe resigned. Jacob Mudenda, Speaker of Zimbabwe's Parliament.
Notice of resignation.
There has been no confirmation or denial of the letter from Mr. Mugabe or his office, and he and his wife Grace have not been seen publicly for days. Celebrations broke out in Parliament after Mudenda read the letter of resignation, and outside, much more of the same. Mugabe was fired as leader of the ruling ZANU-PF party Tuesday. Parliament had begun impeachment proceedings when the letter was delivered and read. The impeachment motion included charges of abusing authority by naming his wife, Grace Mugabe, as successor. That step, taken after firing popular military hero and former vice president Emmerson Mnangagwa. Zimbabwe's state-run broadcaster says Emmerson Mnangagwa will be sworn in as the country's new president Friday. The former vice president is expected in Zimbabwe at any time. He abruptly fled the country after Mugabe fired him on November 6th. Adeola Fahen is with Sahara Television.
Is that democracy in Zimbabwe, sir? Is there democracy in Zimbabwe? There is no democracy in Zimbabwe. Very, very sad. It's about time. It's about time to step down.
For years, there has been increasing pressure for the now 93-year-old leader to step down. And for years, the U.S. has sanctioned the Mugabe government for its increasing assault on its people's human rights and the rule of law.
We all should work together for a quick return to civilian rule in that country in accordance with their constitution. Zimbabwe has an opportunity to set itself on a new path, one that must include democratic elections and respect for human rights.
In Kenya, Chief Justice David Maraga.
The presidential election of the 26th October is hereby upheld, as is the election of the third respondent.
Uhuru Kenyatta is president of Kenyatta for another term. The Supreme Court's unanimous ruling Monday that Kenyatta won last month's runoff vote, with the court's petition's dismissal and striking down arguments that election laws were not followed. The decision following 3 days of hearings. Opposition leader Raila Odinga boycotted the second runoff vote and called for international intervention in the country's election crisis.
I want to see people begin to talk about secession or wanting out of Project Kenya. It basically tells you that something is seriously wrong with Kenya that must be addressed and before the country tears apart.
The chairman of the Electoral Commission, Wafulu Chebukati, said the unanimous decision by the court affirms the IEBC's resolve and efforts to conduct a free, fair, and credible election. After the ruling, some Kenyatta supporters took to the streets in celebration. Elsewhere, not everyone was so pleased. Kenyatta is expected to be sworn in November 28th. The opposition says they'll not recognize his presidency and continue fighting for what they call electoral justice. And, again, we could see Emmerson Mnangagwa sworn in as the new president of Zimbabwe as early as Friday. Paul Sisko, VOA News, Washington.
The former vice president of Zimbabwe, Emmerson Mnangagwa, arrived in the country and gave a speech to a crowd of supporters. Emmerson Mnangagwa, of course, the crocodile, is back, as he promised last week. Well, thanks, Paul Sisko, for that report. And joining us here in the VOA studios are two distinguished guests. My colleague, Blessing Zuru, VOA Studio 7 reporter, and Dr. Arikana Chihombori Kwao, the African Union ambassador to the United States of America. Well, I have to be very honest with you that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host two gallant Zimbabweans on Straight Talk Africa today.
Thank you so much, Chaka.
You're most welcome.
Thank you for having us, Chaka.
You're most welcome, Madam Ambassador. And joining us from the VOA Bureau in New York is David Onserio Monda, Department of Political Science at the City University of New York. Thank you so much, Professor, for joining us again on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you for having me, Chaka.
You're most welcome. Well, let me come to you immediately. What is your immediate reaction, really, especially given that the crocodile has actually, you know, made it happen? I mean, he said, look, I have run away from Zimbabwe, but I'll be back in Zimbabwe. And ZANU-PF does not belong to President Mugabe, his wife, and his family. It's not his or their private property. We are going to make sure that they are the ones who actually have to leave ZANU-PF. It has happened.
It has happened, but also in a rather unfortunate way for Zimbabwe, because essentially this is a military coup in Zimbabwe, because after Mnangagwa was kicked out, he went into exile temporarily. Of course, like you are saying, he promised that he'll be back. And then you had the military taking over on Wednesday. And when it looked like the international community, the regional bloc, the Southern African Development Community, SADC, was going to denounce this move, because, of course, Chaka, you know, military coups are now out of fashion.
That is correct.
So that's when they moved also to try another approach. That is the constitutional approach. Recall Mr. Mugabe. They recalled him. He said he was not stepping down. So they tried another means. They went to parliament, worked with the opposition movement for democratic change to impeach him. So the writing was on the wall for Mr. Mugabe, and he had to step down.
Now, what about you, Madam Ambassador? You obviously work for the African Union. And was this a coup
or not a coup? Definitely not a coup.
Why?
It's in the constitution that the army stepped in to maintain peace because of the conditions on the ground at that time, but this was not a coup.
Does the army have the right, according to the Zimbabwean constitution, to play a police role?
They have a role to stabilize the situation in the country when called to do so. this clearly was a time that we needed the army to move in temporarily to stabilize the situation.
Have you heard reports, for example, that the Zimbabwean police actually went to the Zimbabwean International Airport, Harare International Airport, before, of course, it was named President Robert Gabriel Mugabe International Airport, to arrest the commander of the Zimbabwe Armed Forces, a General Constantino Chiwenga, when he returned from China?
I have not heard of that report, no.
They sent the police to arrest him, but fortunately, the army was aware and had actually sent commandos who were dressed in civilian uniform at the airport, and as soon as the plane touched down, they basically showed who they were.
Again, those are rumors. I've not heard that side of the story.
I see. What about you, Professor Monda? Your reaction to the events in Harare?
I think my reaction is one of a lot of concern, because the people are celebrating in the streets, but fundamentally the structure and system in Zimbabwe with the ZANU-PF, the advantage of the ZANU-PF, the culture of breach of a constitution and of fundamental voting rights of the people has been going on for 37 years. So whereas the people might celebrate that the head of the system, which is former President Mugabe, is out of place, fundamentally the structures of repression are still in place. And my concern here is to what extent will the constitution be followed, and to what extent will other players in the opposition, individuals in exile, all the millions of the Zimbabweans in the diaspora, to what extent will they be involved in this process? And to what extent will ZANU-PF afford a transitionary period where all the players can be involved in an interim administration before elections are called for all Zimbabweans to choose the next course of action for the country? So mine, rather than euphoria, I'm very concerned on the way forward, thinking about what the transition will be.
Very interesting. You are a political scientist and a historian, and I'm sure that you remember what happened in the Portuguese capital, Lisbon, back in 1974. We're talking about the captain's coup, sometimes, in fact, referred to as the Carnation Revolution, where young men, yes, and women carried flowers, roses, to soldiers in tanks and APCs who had actually overthrown a dictatorship. And after that, what happened to Portugal? Democracy. Couldn't this happen in Zimbabwe?
I think it would be very dangerous to conflate the two situations. I think Zimbabwe, this is 2017. Portugal, this was in the mid-70s. Two countries with very different political traditions, very different political environments. Let's not forget that Portugal was within the framework of the European Union. And Portugal was looking to be to join the family of countries in the European Union that emphasized the rule of law and democracy. So my challenge to our AU representative there in your studio is, to what extent will the AU be directly involved in this process, like the European Union was in the case of Portugal, so that Mnangagwa doesn't usurp the constitution and continue with some of the autocratic procedures of Mr. Mugabe in Zimbabwe, and that Zimbabweans will finally have a voice? Because in many cases, the AU seems to be very reactive rather than proactive in coercing some of these dictators, be it Museveni in Uganda, be it Mugabe in Zimbabwe, to change their ways and allow for the people to have their voice.
You talk, of course, about how those two examples cannot really be compared, because one has a different type of European environment and probably wants to join the majority of Western Europe. But what about the fact that during that time you also had Albania, Romania, and other countries which were part of Europe, and they couldn't actually be liberated until 1989?
Yes, correct. So obviously the environments with countries like Romania, Albania, the former Czechoslovakia, were very different because they were under the domination of the Soviet Union. We had pseudo-autocratic rulers in those countries, B.H. Ceausescu, you know, in Romania, and some of the other despots that were installed by the Soviet Union. But here we have a new light, an opportunity for Zimbabwe to chart a new course and essentially to set a precedent for some of the other rulers in Africa, Museveni on one hand, Paul Kagame on the other, to figure out that we need to have certain democratic transitions. We cannot have these leaders in power for 30, 40 years, whereas there's a human resource pool in the country which can really afford a tremendous opportunity for change, for new leadership, for fresh opportunities for leadership. So it's really interesting. It's a really opportune moment for Zimbabwe to chart a new course. But how this course will be midwifed by the AU, by SADC, and by the rest of the African community, we are yet to see.
Very interesting. Well, Zulu, you obviously have heard Professor Monda. What about the fact that the African environment, especially in Southern Africa, also, I think, provides some really optimism, because you're talking about neighboring South Africa, which is democratic, no question about it. You're talking about neighboring Botswana. You're talking about Namibia.
Indeed.
What about that?
Yeah, I think the region has been peaceful, but you should also mention that we have occasional problems in Lesotho. And lately, Zambia, there's been, you know, problems there. But
Malawi,
Mozambique,
yeah. Malawi, is
Malawi
sort of,
yeah, not bad. Then you go to Mozambique, you know, there's always the threat of RENAMO. But the region is, you know, very stable. That way, I think it can continue to attract the much needed investment. But of course, the problem has always been that the elections, I think I would rather call them electoralism, you know, in some of these countries. In Zimbabwe, for example, that is what has been happening, in that going for elections is just a ritual. You know, the elections, there are allegations that they are rigged, you know. So if the AU and also SADC, which is the regional bloc, do not move in on time, you have problems like Zimbabwe is currently facing, in that people don't have faith in elections. And if they don't have faith in elections, you now have the military intervening, you know, doing what the police is supposed to be doing if there are criminals that are to be arrested. And even as we speak, you know, all the streets are manned by the military. The police are nowhere to be seen. It's a big problem.
Madam Ambassador, what about that? There are a lot of people who say, and including, in fact, several African heads of state, that they now hold what they characterize as, quote-unquote, periodic elections. Why not quality elections? Why not, in fact, elections whose results reflect the will of the people, not the will of the gun, not the will of the man or woman who actually counts the vote or announces the results?
Again, we need to not blanket Africa as one election.
No, no, no,
each
not
country,
all of Africa.
Well, your question is general.
Yes,
it's general, but it is a general question. But we have
most
to look
African
at each,
countries.
Let's look at each situation for what it is. Let's look at Zimbabwe. Let's not underestimate the people of Zimbabwe. If you look at the demonstrations that took place this week and part of last week, peaceful demonstrations. Thousands of people came out. Zimbabweans are very politicized people. Zimbabweans, because of what we have been through, we understand the issues, which is why you did not see any violence, no looting during the demonstrations.
Incredible.
Let's not underestimate the Zimbabweans. Let's not underestimate the
Incredible.
Zimbabweans.
In fact, talking about that, what was really behind seeing an army that is very, very disciplined this time, very civil, and also the ordinary people in the streets of Harare, despite the fact that they are we are talking about an environment where people are so poor, not reports of any looting at all?
Well, first of all, you must realize we're dealing with two issues here. while the Zimbabweans may have wanted change, we, as African people, as Zimbabweans, we also respect our elders. They still respect Mugabe. They understand what Mugabe stood for, not only for the Zimbabweans, for the continent, but for black people around the globe. So Zimbabweans are very clear about that. Yes, they wanted change, but at the same time, they wanted their leader to be respected. He is our father. He is our elder. And Zimbabweans are very clear about that. So, which is why they stood up, they let the president know that it was time for change. And we're glad that the president did listen to them, and this time the president heard them. Let's not misunderstand the Zimbabweans and the leadership that's getting ready to take the reign. They also understand the issues. Let's not misunderstand the Zimbabweans. Zimbabweans are far advanced when it comes to understanding the issues and being politicized.
It's very interesting that you keep saying Zimbabweans, and yet there are some people who will say, wait a minute, this was not really a Zimbabwean people's uprising. This was simply a conflict, really, between elites within the ruling ZANU-PF.
When I talk about Zimbabweans needing change, what you saw on the streets were Zimbabweans. It was the voices of those masses that President Mugabe reacted to. So the conflict may have been sparked by the elite, but the people who were on the street were the Zimbabweans, and that's who spoke.
You think he just reacted to those people, really, or was it the AK-47 that he no longer controlled?
It was a combination.
And the diplomatic... the diplomatic problems that he faced, because he, frankly, he didn't seem to have support from almost anywhere except probably Uganda and some very few countries.
Again, the writing was on the wall and had been for a while. So all I'm saying is the Zimbabweans understood the issues. They came out, they voiced their opinions through their masses, and the president saw them and he listened.
We'll come back to Zimbabwe, of course. Monde, talk to us about the developments in your country, Kenya. What happens next week? We obviously are going to have incumbent president Uhuru Kenyatta, who is now, at least according to the Kenyan Supreme Court, president-elect being sworn in on Tuesday next week.
Yes, he will. And... Fortunately, it's the end of a very challenging political season. But very much like Zimbabwe, in the Kenyan situation, you know, you didn't really have the military having to enforce or midwife a transition. We had an election, albeit disputed, that that was able to come to fruition. If you compare, again, the two scenarios, Kenya and Zimbabwe, Zimbabwe has had one leader since 1980. I think with Kenya, the transition has been, we're going on almost the fifth president. There's been multiple transitions and handovers of power, which is a good thing. But again, in the Kenyan situation, there still is that challenge of constitutionalism. To what extent the institutions for electoral transition, specifically the Independent Boundaries and Electoral Commission in Kenya, to what extent the judiciary is free, and to what extent the political players are able to consolidate democracy and to allow for transitions of power. So in both cases, there are challenges. In the Kenyan situation, somewhat better, but still, President Uhuru has a major challenge in terms of bringing half of the country that did not vote for him on board. And it's going to be interesting to see what avenues he affords the opposition to re-engage in the political process, specifically inviting Raila Odinga to also be a player, and a lot of the opposition that didn't vote for Uhuru Kenyatta to come on board and carry the country forward for another 5 years.
It's very interesting that you talk about half the country probably which did not come out to vote for him. As a matter of fact, when you look at the facts, it's quite possible that he may not, in fact, have had 30% of the registered voters really turning out to vote. As a matter of fact, it looks like probably more than 60% of the country does not seem to be with him. What about some reports suggesting that the opposition in NASA also plans to inaugurate Raila Amolo Odinga as their president?
Well, I think I've heard those reports, and I'm not sure that will be very helpful on the part of the opposition. I think this is a fait accompli. If we are really to, if the opposition is really to say that they follow the rule of law and they respect the courts, as they were happy and respected the ruling of the Supreme Court when it ruled in their favor to annul the elections, I think they should be able to also accept the decision of the Supreme Court when the Supreme Court decides against what the opposition feels should be the result. I deeply feel that the opposition needs to set an agenda for the people's work to get done. The opposition won a lot of seats in the counties. Raila Odinga won a lot of seats in many parts of the country at the governor level, at the member of the county assembly level. So the country faces a lot of problems, inflation, unemployment, insecurity. We have the situation of Kenyan troops in Somalia, Al-Shabaab, terrorism. I really think it's about time that the electioneering ends and politicians go into the legislature, go into parliament, and really start handling the tough business of the people's work, getting all these problems resolved.
Talk to us about the opposition's, of course, tactics, for example, of declaring a boycott on some of the major corporations in Kenya. We're talking about Bidco. We're talking about some of the major, corporations belonging to the Uhuru family. What about that? And we're talking about, of course, Safaricom. The last time I checked, it looks like when you look at the Kenyan Stock Exchange, it doesn't seem to be doing well at all.
Yes, I think that's an interesting strategy the opposition has identified. Whereas in principle, economic boycotts on many, many administrations around the world has been one of the tools of defiance. But the question begs, Shaka, to what extent or how did the opposition determine that these three companies need to be boycotted? What was the criteria? Let's not forget, both opposition and Jubilee people and people all over the world invest in these publicly listed companies. What will the consequences of boycotting these companies be? Last but not least, let's also remember that a lot of opposition members also are very wealthy people. So if the opposition is to boycott the Jubilee administration companies or perceived companies, then should the government supporters also boycott the companies owned by Raila Odinga and a lot of the elite in the opposition? I really think this is a dead-end move on the part of the opposition. Again, it's really important that our legislators get to parliament and start to deal with the problems that the country is facing. A lot of the debt, the crippling debt from the loans we've borrowed from the Chinese, and most importantly, the work of reforming the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission so that in 2020, 5 years from now, we don't have another cycle of disputed elections. We have the rule of law followed. We have a very transparent, clear, and open election, and the country is able to move forward.
Well, are you really surprised that the opposition is taking on Brookside, for example, which obviously is one of the major, major dairy industries in the region and belongs, of course, to the Uhuru Kenyatta family?
I'm not surprised. And like I said, it's their right to boycott the companies that are owned by the elites in the government. But then where will we end it, going down that road? Then will the interests and the companies owned by Raila Odinga and owned by a lot of the senators and governors in the opposition, will those companies be boycotted? When Brookside buys milk, it's a company that buys milk. It buys from both opposition and government strong areas. So I think fundamentally in terms of the economy, that will be a route to sabotage the economy. And unless the opposition really clearly identifies a mantra and a module through which economic boycott will lead to the reform of the Electoral Commission, to a slashing of the members of parliament, senators, and government governor's salaries, to the extent that that will help bring down inflation and give the youth jobs, I would say that they should go all hands in. But to the extent that that really fundamentally doesn't address the people's problems in terms of increasing employment, in terms of reducing the insecurity and reducing the level of debt that the country faces, I think it's, again, it's a dead-end route, and the opposition really needs to go back to parliament and start dealing with the people's problems, including reforming the Electoral Commission.
Well, you are tuned into Straight Talk Africa, and we have more of a discussion in a moment, including our social media segment. So please, don't go away, because we'll be right back with you.
We are able to touch on things that are important to people on an everyday basis. We hope that our viewers are getting inspired when they watch our show. They're getting a view of the world from a different perspective, things that perhaps are not in their immediate vicinity. Today, I could put in on the show something that is a little different, a little unique, and this gives me that inspiration to come to work.
Today's youth are not just the next generation of African leaders, they are today's leaders. And this is the time to invest in them, today, not tomorrow. So let's connect, let's engage with each other on issues that will transform our societies. Innovation, leadership, entrepreneurship, things that you're doing to move the continent forward to make you the greatest generation that Africa has known. It's Upfront every Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa, live from Washington. It's time to bring in our social media reporter, Ayen Bior. Take it away, Ayen.
Well, thanks, Shaka. This week, major political developments are taking place in both Kenya and Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe's state-run broadcaster says Emmerson Mnangagwa will be sworn in as the country's new president, taking over for longtime leader Robert Mugabe. And in Kenya, the Supreme Court on Monday upheld President Uhuru Kenyatta's re-election in the repeat presidential poll last month, paving the way for his swearing in next week. Well, this brings us to our question of the week, which asks, how should the African Union ensure that social justice will prevail in Africa, given the latest political events in Kenya and Zimbabwe? Well, let's start the conversation with a tweet from West Coast, who writes, the only and possible means to ensure social justice in Africa is that the AU should stop taking orders from France. It should be solely independent in its decision and take quick actions during African crises. And we have another tweet from Philip Onen, who says, stop making excuses for corrupt leaders. Remove the option of immunity, which absolves them of consequences for self-seeking governance, and hold them accountable. Be brave to sanctioning its errant peers. Well, now to our social media comment of the week from Facebook fan Wamala Philip in Uganda. He says, whatever is happening in Kenya or Zimbabwe is part of the shortcomings of democracy. Presidential transitions in Africa are often expected to be violent because we've made the presidency a big deal. The African Union, being just a block of African countries, can only offer diplomatic solutions like calling for dialogue to avoid being partisan. Well, let's go to another comment from Facebook fan Wycliffe Barasa from Kenya, who writes, the African Union needs to be independent with bias organization. It should not defend crooks and looters. The AU is good at giving written information and ideas, but it is hard for them to implement them. Agenda 2063 of the AU has every solution, but there is no implementation. The AU is still being enslaved by the European Union, United Nations, United States, and other Western organizations. And our last Facebook comment comes from Andrew Mwiba of Zambia, who writes, the AU should be proactive and not reactive. Right now, there are some leaders in Africa who are students of Mugabe and Museveni. What is the AU doing now to make sure we do not have such situations like Zimbabwe or Kenya? Election observing by AU is not genuine at all. Well, a reminder that we appreciate all of the audience feedback. If you're a new fan, drop us a line at africatv@voanews.com. To comment on our Facebook page, just enter the keywords Straight Talk Africa. Be sure to visit us online at voaafrica.com. To join our YouTube channel, sign up to VOA TV to Africa. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Shaka. Straight Talk Africa streams live every Wednesday on Facebook, or simply go to VOA Straight Talk Africa TV program page on our website. To watch us live on your mobile device, just download the VOA mobile app. Now let's take a look at what's on tap for next week's program. Next week on Straight Talk Africa, every child deserves to be happy and safe. We'll hear from three African women making a difference in the lives of thousands of orphans and other needy children through their non-governmental organizations. That's next week, right here on Straight Talk Africa. Well, that's all for today's social media segment. Shaka, you and the guest have a lot of social media comments to discuss. Back to you.
Indeed. Thank you so much for sharing some social media reaction with us. And, of course, it's a pleasure always to listen to those types of opinions. Well, welcome back. And today's topic is the reaction to the latest political developments in Kenya and Zimbabwe. Our distinguished guests are my colleague, Blessing Zulu, VOA Studio 7 reporter, Dr. Alikana Chihomboli Kwao, the African Union Ambassador to the United States of America, and David Onserio Monda, Department of Political Science, City University of New York, who joins us from VOA Bureau in New York, the Big Apple. Well, I have to say, Madam Ambassador, and of course, Blessing and David, that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have an opportunity to host the three of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. It looks like we should actually immediately come to you, Madam Ambassador, because it looks like the social media seem to be pretty much pointing a finger at the important African Union institution. Your reaction?
Yes, African Union is the big mother, and they can handle complaints, and most of the complaints, rightfully so. But you also have to realize the union is membership is voluntary, and the union is limited in terms of
voluntary.
The membership.
Why should isn't that should they have really like some benchmarks to meet?
Yes, there are benchmarks to meet. However, a country can leave the union if they choose to. So there's only so far the union can push.
Morocco did at one time.
Morocco did at one time.
And, it was, and now it is back in the AU.
And it was very difficult for Morocco to come back. Be it as it may, it is what it is. The conversations are taking place at a much higher level. If you look at when the union was created, first as OAU and later on as AU, the pace at which the conversations are taking place at this time are at a much higher level. If you look at Agenda 2063 and the seven aspirations of the African people, those are self-imposed, I would say, yardstick that the heads of states have said, we will use this to measure our own progress within our own countries. Again, even when you look at the African peer review mechanism, it's again a voluntary
process. They actually account to themselves?
Absolutely. I have been privy to be in the room when the heads of states were giving their own reports based on Agenda 2063, and I can tell you it was refreshing to actually see some of the leaders give themselves failing grades.
And you actually expect them to be objective about that?
We are moving in the right direction. I can honestly tell you, under the leadership of President Kagame, who is leading the African reform process, we are really moving in the right direction and in big strides.
There are a lot of critics, of course, who will differ with you. But let me ask you another question. You heard, obviously, some of these people were accusing you for being influenced by either France or the United Kingdom or Western Europe or the United States or some of that kind of sort. Is that true?
Well, let me put it this way. When you look at the situation in Africa in general pertaining to the to our colonial masters, if you look at the deep roots that countries like France, Belgium have in Africa, wherein lies our problem? The trying to uproot our colonial masters is turning out to be a monumental task. We quibble with how do we get France out of Francophone Africa? How do we stop the billions of dollars coming out of Africa every year, poor Africa into France? We quibble with the realization that we are the quote-unquote third world country, and yet we are giving to the first world country. And the realization that if we could just stop the looting out of Africa that's happening, being done by our colonial masters, we actually are the, can be the developed country, and France can easily slide into a third world country. Those are issues that we're having to deal with. But again, as AU, we cannot address those by ourselves. They have to go back to the states, because at the end of the day is the relationship between the state and France. So it's not an easy task. It's easy to blame the AU, and we will take it. We will own what we need to own, but we also must understand that it is not an easy situation. There are multiple layers that must be dealt with in order to get to the core of the issue.
We know that the beautiful headquarters building in Addis Ababa was donated to the African Union by the people of China. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So what about also others who say that the greater part, really, of the African Union budget is paid by foreigners?
Well, I have to say, we are also aware of that, and that in order for us to really be self-sufficient and call the shots, we must fund ourselves. So beginning January this year, there is going to be a 0.2% levy that's going to be imposed on certain items imported into Africa, and that's more than enough to fund the African Union.
Obviously, because you know whoever pays the piper does what? Chorus the tune.
That's correct.
Professor Monda.
Yes.
Do you have any ideas that how, for example, the African Union could improve itself, find itself in a position where it can be really in a situation where it can to begin seriously influencing events on the African continent, especially the democratization of the continent and good governance?
I think, Shaka, you hit on a very important... The funding is particularly key. You know, he that pays the piper plays the tune. You find that a majority of the African Union budget is actually funded by foreigners, be it the EU, the Americans, or the Chinese. You raise the issue of the African Union headquarters. How sure are we that the Chinese are not listening into African debates, plenary sessions, and very sensitive debates, given that actually the whole thing for the continent to have, you know, the Chinese build, a headquarters for an African Union. But I think fundamentally, structurally, Shaka, the AU really needs to deepen its bureaucracy in terms of investing within the African states themselves. It's very thin in terms of our horizontal bureaucratization. The emphasis in terms of implementation in each lot of the AU is really thin. So you tend to find a lot of resolutions being passed that are really not followed up. And sanctions are not really imposed in terms of going against some of those community norms. So, for example, democratization, free and fair elections. Many of the despots on the continent tend to go against a constitution at will without the African Union doing any In terms of budget, that's one big area. In terms of bureaucratization, that's another area, deepening the bureaucratization and the enforcement in each country. But thirdly, creating an environment where norms that are established in the AU in Addis Ababa are destined to all the members, including in Ethiopia itself, where we have some of these contradictions of repression and human rights abuses.
Very interesting. Blessing, you know, when you talk about the Chinese, it looks clearly that you're looking at perhaps a new world order here. Mm-hmm. It used to be, for example, that coups mm-hmm. affecting African countries or Latin America or wherever, they were hatched in Washington, mm-hmm. they were hatched in London, in Paris, and what have you. The first coup, for example, on the African continent was back in 1963 mm. By a sergeant, Eyasimbe Eyadema, mm-hmm. who had been part of the French army
yeah.
and actually kicked out Silverson, this man called Olympio.
Mm-hmm.
1963, the coup made in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
The second coup, Nigeria, it was made in, not Nigeria, it was Ghana, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
It was led by a major Kwasi Afrifa, Sandhurst trained.
Mm-hmm.
It was hatched in London, people will tell you. The second one, also 1966 in Nigeria, by Major Chukwuma Kaduna Nziyogu, Sandhurst trained.
Mm-hmm.
Idi Amin, 1971, it was said to be British, could be London, could be Tel Aviv, mm-hmm. and Washington. And I don't know whether you heard this, but the coup, apparently, in Harare, mm-hmm. may actually be made in China.
That's true. There are those reports, and we've also tried to follow up on those reports because you mentioned at the top of the show that there were attempts to arrest General Constantino Chiwenga.
Mm-hmm.
Where was he coming from? He was coming from China. And you also have Emmerson Mnangagwa, the president designate. He, during the Liberation War, also trained in China.
Correct.
And, of course, there are many who say that he has the backing of the Chinese government, although some analysts say, you know, the British really like him in that he might reform the state. But I think if you look at the whole ZANU-PF structure, mm-hmm. because of the Liberation War, they are very, very close to China. And you look at most of the business deals that the... previous Mugabe or the former President Mugabe government inked,
mm-hmm.
it was with the Chinese much more than anybody else. What not about, for former colonial power,
what about
Britain, of course.
What about their mode of development, their policies, development policies? We're talking about command agriculture,
mm-hmm.
command education, mm-hmm. and what have you. What mm-hmm. about that?
Yeah, you see, that's where the other problem is, that if you look at those... policies that they are implementing now, they failed in China, in the former Soviet Union, in Cuba, Havana.
Mm.
But they are, you know, this goes back to their roots because most of these, the Mugabes, the Mnangagwas, are what you can call Marxists. Mm. But the problem that I see in Africa is that China has reformed. You know, there are leadership changes in China.
Was Mugabe really a Marxist?
One might argue that he was, but I think it's his ideas were Marxist.
What about his lifestyle?
His lifestyle, no.
Very capitalist.
Yes. I think his lifestyle, he was more of a British gentleman.
More of a British gentleman, of course,
indeed.
With impeccable suits.
Indeed.
And incredible villas in Hong Kong. In Johannesburg,
mm-hmm.
in Kuala Lumpur, and mm-hmm. what have you.
Indeed. So they might have been, you know, portraying themselves as Marxists and all, but their lifestyle, like you are correctly pointing out, did not reflect that.
That makes some people really miss people like Zambia's founding president, Kenneth Kaunda.
Indeed.
Who spent 27 years in the state house, but actually left without a single house.
Mm-hmm.
People like... Tanzania's founding leader,
mm-hmm.
Julius Kambarage Nyerere,
mm-hmm.
people like Kwame Nkrumah, the Osagyefo,
mm-hmm.
the Ghanaian founding leader, and the man that had the vision thing, frankly, for decolonizing Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And
even Mandela did not have much.
And of course,
you know,
the Madiba mm-hmm. himself. And even, by the way, you could talk about Sir Seretse Khama
mm-hmm.
of Botswana.
Indeed.
Very interesting. Yeah. In fact, I'm also told, and frankly, I've done some homework, I cannot trace any properties belonging to a man called Mengisu Haile Mariam, who happens to be, of course, in Zimbabwe.
Interesting.
Very interesting. You wanted to tell us about something to do with Libya.
The latest on Libya. Getting a lot of calls on that. There are some stories going around that there are some people who are selling Africans, in North Africa.
Slavery again, back.
Absolutely. I think I was actually driving around the streets of Washington with the chairman of the AU when we also got wind of the story. Whether it is true or not, we don't know, but the African Union is definitely looking into it. It has launched an investigation. So for those who were thinking that African Union is sitting back and watching Africans sell each other, the truth of the matter is we found out the same way that the rest of the world found out about what may be going on. We absolutely condemn any acts of violence and human rights abuses, and the leadership in Libya has also taken a similar position. But I think we also need to look at it and say, how did Libya get to be in such a condition of lawlessness? Let's not forget that the manner in which Gaddafi was removed left this void that is now making Libya the gateway for not only terrorists, but criminals to float into Africa from different parts of the world.
Right.
So when you look at the situation in Libya, it's not that simple.
It was caused by the UN Security Council.
Absolutely.
Is that correct?
Absolutely. And I think they need to take ownership of the responsibility. We are taking ownership at the African Union. The issues of peace and security, are pivotal at the African Union. Over 60% of our budget goes to peace and security because we believe strongly that there cannot be any development in any country without peace and security. So the issue of what's going on in Libya, we condemn it absolutely as the African Union, and everything is being done to investigate the situation to make sure it doesn't fall into fake news. And it is deplorable and unacceptable in every way. So it's sad that we can be, as African Union, be blamed for a situation of criminals in Libya who are committing horrible crime. These are just thugs and criminals committing crimes, and they have to be stopped.
You're right in saying, of course, that the UN Security Council was really responsible for probably creating the conditions that now obtain in Libya.
Absolutely. You know, they set our house on fire,
yes,
and then they run away saying, hey, your house on fire, why aren't you putting it off?
But the last time I checked, there were also three countries on the Security Council which came from Africa. We're talking about South Africa. Mm-hmm. We're talking about Gabon, and I think I remember Nigeria. They all voted with the rest of the other countries. All of the 15 members voted for that operation.
And that is unfortunate, because the African Union was actually working with Gaddafi, and the African Union would have wanted to have a little bit more time to work with Gaddafi in order to avoid what we ended up having in Libya. But it is what it is. This is where we are. And as African Union, we are playing our role in doing whatever we can to bring stability and hopefully create conditions that can lead to elections and a stable government in Libya.
Would it be fair to say that, you know, there are reasons really why some people look at the AU and say, yes, does it have teeth? Yes, it does have teeth. The question is, can it in fact bite?
Well, you know, we are not giving AU the credit that it deserves. This is not an easy task. You are looking at 55 different nations, 55 sovereign nations, and trying to bring them to a consensus on every issue. That's a monumental task.
But you have no sovereignty.
Absolutely. There becomes the issue, which is why we have to work with the leadership. But I can honestly tell you, if you look, for example, the situation in Gambia, AU was very instrumental in making sure that the president stepped aside. AU is working behind the scenes in every key area that we are having issues. We have issues of democracy in Central Africa, you know, in the Great Lakes region. We have issues of terrorism in the G5 Sahel, in the Horn of Africa. AU is everywhere. The Commissioner for Peace and Security, he runs around like a chicken without a head throughout the whole continent trying to put out fires. This I know for a fact. It is happening. It's just that we don't talk about it because it's all work in progress. But AU is very involved in every issue that has to do with peace and security on the continent.
Madam Ambassador, there are some people who do not understand the difference between the African Union Commission and the African Union, because you have actually the chairperson or the chairman of the African Union Commission and the chairman of the African Union. What are the differences?
The African Union is the committee that that's made up of the African leaders themselves. And then the African Union Commission is the working organ of the African Union.
The secretariat?
Absolutely.
Including you?
Including myself, yes.
Very interesting. Professor Monda.
Yes.
I did not forget you. What is the way forward?
I think in terms of the African Union, again, establishing norms for leadership and for governance on the continent. And, you know, I think like Madam Commissioner has said, it is a challenge trying to get 55 different leaders to speak with one voice. But I think fundamentally there are certain norms that should be established about the rule of law, about free and fair elections. It's a pity here that we should be talking about one of the founding fathers of Africa, a liberation hero who, Robert Mugabe, who led, a country, who raised a country to independence, who raised fundamental questions about social justice, about universal suffrage. You know, the British didn't bring democracy to Zimbabwe. It's the guns and the bullets and the organization of Mugabe and his comrades that was able to bring liberation to Zimbabwe. It's unfortunate that 37 years later, we're talking about Mugabe like a dictator and a tyrant. And, you know, there's not enough emphasis on a lot of the good that he did. So going forward, I really think the AU needs to establish these norms and these traditions about good governance and the rule of law. And critically, most important, it will be about it finding an independent source of funding so that it's going to be able to implement and enforce a lot of the resolutions that it's raising, be that on migration, be that on immigration policy, or be that on democratization, consolidation of democracy, and the rule of law on the continent.
Thank you. Thank you. Last question, my friend. Mnangagwa talks about consolidating democracy in Zimbabwe. Is there democracy to consolidate in Zimbabwe to the best of your knowledge?
I think at the moment there is nothing. There is need to build key institutions to ensure that democracy is safeguarded and to ensure that the military stays in the barracks. I think that's Zimbabwe's challenge and Africa's challenge as well.
I see. On that note, thanks to our three distinguished guests, my colleague Blessing Zuru, Dr. Arikana Chihombori Kwau, and David Onserio Monda. Thanks to our affiliate stations, along with our viewers and listeners. For many of our Voice of America radio affiliates, Learning English is coming up next, and tomorrow morning is Daybreak Africa with James Bate. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not beta, Kenya and Zimbabwe and, of course, Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.